It's a Cab Chat interview.
Where you're hearing things. Where you're hearing things.
In this episode, I interview John Mason, the ex-director of London Taxi and Private Hire, or as it used to be called, the Public Carriage Office.
Right, so I'm sitting here with John Mason, ex-director of, what is it, London Taxi and Private Hire?
Well, you could say the old Public Carriage Office.
The old Public Carriage Office, yeah. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. Good to see you again.
And you. So, obviously, as I just said, you was the director of LTPH, as it became called. Yeah. How did you actually get into the job, John?
Well, I guess it was a long journey, Jamie. I mean, I started my career in Westminster Council, and then I joined TfL in 2001 as the head of enforcement for congestion charging. So I did that for quite a few years, which was quite good, a quite interesting job. And then about summer of 2009, had a chat with the then chief operating officer of enforcement. I won't mention any names, but he basically said to me, Ed Thompson is due to move on and do something different in TfL, and would I be interested in applying for the job? He didn't offer me the job. I'd had to apply for the job in competition with others, and there was competition. There were other people interested in the job. And, I just talked through the job with him about what he saw as the challenges, what TfL were looking for. And it just really interested me. I was deputy director at the time of congestion charging, and it just seemed like a really good challenge, something I've been interested in. I did some work with Ed and his team with congestion charging when congestion charging came in, because we obviously had to license the cabs to make sure they didn't get congestion charging penalties. So that's some kind of level of work with the team. I just thought it was going to be really interesting and challenging. So I joined in, I'm trying to think of the date now. I almost forget the date. But it's definitely set by around about September 2009.
And did you bring Helen Chapman with you, or did she?
Yeah, not straight away. Helen had worked for me in congestion charging for, probably about 6 or 7 years, maybe longer. I'm sure she'll listen to this and text me and tell me I was messed up my dates. But
she normally does things
like that. So but Helen had been a really good person working for me. She'd done a really good job for me in congestion charging. And when I came in, one of the things I wanted to do was I came in as director, and I just wanted somebody to come in initially just to have a look at the operation, the way that we worked, the way we issued licenses, the way that we answered our telephone calls, the way that we did our vehicle inspections, and just give me kind of almost an independent view as to, you know, what might some of the challenges be, where we might be able to make some improvements. So initially she came on, I think it was in the January 2010, had a look around the business and did me a report basically, and said, you know, there's some things here that I think you could do and improve and change. So I set about changing the structure of the directorate. Ed had, probably about 6 or 7 direct reports. I thought that was too many and we should trim it down a little bit. So I changed, did an organisational change. A good example of that would be, taxi drivers would sometimes try and get through to our call centre, and we'd have people on one floor that were responsible for answering minicab calls or calls from the private hire trade, who could be sat there doing no work because they weren't getting any calls, whereas there'd be a waiting list on the taxi side. So what we tried to do was try and bring about some kind of sensible efficiencies to make sure that, you know, not getting rid of headcount, but just trying to make sure that, you know, if we've got some people that have got some spare capacity, let's use them to try and answer the calls and stuff like that. So through that structure, I created a deputy director role, and Helen again applied for it in competition with quite a few others, and she got the job. I'm trying to think when she joined, probably about the spring of 2010.
So had the carriage office already moved to Palestra then?
No. So one of the, actually it was quite interesting. So I kind of joined it was interesting. So I joined as the director, and I had a long list of things that I wanted to look at, and we can talk about some of these things, the way that the knowledge worked, and the way that the back office systems were working. So I thought that was quite a big challenge. Yeah. But then very early on, I got told the mayor's got this air quality strategy thing that he wants to introduce. So that was something else to add to my list. And then I got told that we needed to get out of Penton Street because they needed a depot, basically, for the mayor's cycle hire scheme. And that wasn't the only reason. Also, you've got to understand that kind of Penton Street was in these old... I always used to say it looked like a prison from the outside and felt like a prison on the inside. And that was very much the case. It wasn't really... I don't know, you're probably very familiar with it, but, you went into the reception. You had this kind of dark and danky reception. You went upstairs to the counter. It was on separate floors. The facilities for the staff weren't very good. And so the move to Palestra gave us the opportunity to actually move the staff into nice new offices on one floor, all working together, nice modern offices, trying to modernise, to be honest with you, modernise a little bit the service that we'd provided. Because I can be quite straight with you, Jamie, the public carriage office and the way it operated in Penton Street was seen to be quite aloof, authoritarian, that those are the rules type approach to not just the staff but to taxi drivers as well. And I can give you a great example of that. My first day in the job, came in, went upstairs to the third floor where Ed's old office was, spoke to Lorraine, his PA, which was now my PA. She said, I'll make you a nice cup of tea, Mr. Mason, and bring it into your office. And I said, no, don't worry about that, I'm going to go down to the was it the second floor, the taxi counter, or the first floor? I think it was whatever floor the taxi counter was.
So anyway,
wherever the taxi counter was, I said, I'm going to go downstairs, I'm going to sit there and just spend my day there and just have a look and see what goes on. Well, actually, it wasn't that long when some chap came up to the window, pressed the bell. Nobody went up to the counter for it's what seemed like ages, and he was smartly dressed in his suit. I was thinking, if no one else is going to get up, I'm going to go up. So I went up. Hello, sir. How are you doing? He said, I've been told I need to report here. And he had this letter in his hand from the complaints team. And it basically said, dear Mr. Smith, or whatever his name was, we've had a complaint about you. Please attend. Anyway, I don't think he said please. He said, you must attend. Yeah. Penton Street, 3 p.m. Please bring your license, etc., etc. So I thought, okay, well, that's quite a formal letter. So I said, if you wait there, and I went back to the team, and I said, they've got this Mr. Smith at the counter, and looks a bit worried, and he's got this letter. And I'll deal with that. So I said, I'll deal with that. And they went up to the counter, and I went back to my desk, expecting them to deal with it. And the person said, okay, Mr. Smith, you can go. And he kind of looked at her, and she was thinking, well, what's going on here? And he went, we just wanted you to know that, we kind of almost... we can do this to you. Yeah. And I kind of summed up in a way what I felt was, I kind of reinforced some of my views about the old way of working, and there's different people, people say, well, actually, there's standards that have been set over the years. And I just thought that kind of reinforced the way that something I wanted to kind of change and be a little bit more personable.
It's quite funny because my ex-wife works in the old public carriage.
Oh, right.
And what you actually saw when you started was an improvement,
right,
on the way they used to be,
right?
Because she worked for the Met for quite some time, and she transferred up to the public carriage office, and she was the first person to work there who's had a relation who was a taxi driver
in the taxi trade, right?
And she really criticised them.
Yeah.
Although she wasn't in a managerial role, they asked her what she thought, and she said, I think you speak to taxi drivers in a disgusting manner.
I agree.
And they did try to improve.
Yeah.
Because they did take, they sort of took a look at themselves and thought, well, we do a little bit.
There's standards. And, the taxi trade in London, I can guarantee it, I've travelled the world and it is the most respected, beloved taxi trade that there is. And there's no question about that. I was fortunate to go to Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago. and speak at a conference there, and I was on this table, and there was the head of taxi licensing from New York, Boston, I think it was Hawaii, you know, all over the world. Yeah. And they all wanted to speak to me. They all wanted to say, well, what makes the taxi trade in London better than everywhere else? And I kept saying, well, it's the drivers, it's the vehicle, it's the knowledge, it's the standards. But there's a fine line between setting standards and keeping those standards maintained and treating people like human beings.
Yeah.
So that was a challenge. But yeah, so you, in answer to your question, we moved into... So that was another task. I had to get out of Penton Street quite quickly, get us into those offices in Plestra. And I have to say, it was a challenge because staff felt quite at home in Penton Street. It was their little island. You know, they were away from the management and prying eyes, and, you know, the knowledge examiners had their own little offices and... You know, so I think they were quite at home in Penton Street. And I can understand that. And I can understand
There was a lot of criticism when you originally moved to Plestra, because, obviously, as you said, at Penton Street, you had the counter service.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got a lot of older drivers within the cab trade that can't use the internet or whatever. And you went from a building that had public access to a building that had no public access.
Yeah.
Do you think, in that respect, it was a right move, or do you think it could have been a better move?
It's a good question, Jamie. You know, one of the things that I found out early on was that, yes, there are plenty of drivers out there that like that personal experience, like to be able to go in to do a transaction, get advice firsthand, pay in cash. And unfortunately, Plestra just didn't give us that kind of facility. Yeah. It didn't exist. And yeah, you know, it would have perhaps been, in retrospect, it perhaps would have been great to be able to have set up a counter service. The problem is, when people pay cash, and this is a fact, there's no denying it, when people pay cash in an environment such as a counter, cash can go missing. You know, you do often, unfortunately, sometimes get dishonest staff that are opportunist and take the cash that they're supposed to be banking. You have reconciliation issues. But yeah, you know, in hindsight, if I could have done one thing differently in that move, then yeah, but perhaps we might have put in a counter service. Do you know, but at the end of the day, I do feel that what we tried to do was at least try and provide alternatives. So we tried to expand the post office service. We tried to make sure that it was easier to pay over the phone. You know, before I joined, before myself and Helen came in, we didn't even know how many calls were being trying to be made to our offices. There was no system that told us how many people were waiting to have their calls answered. And we quickly identified these as being real issues that we needed to kind of address and try and make sure that we manage our service a little bit better than we had done in the past. But yeah, I understand why people would like counter services. And, you know, if the trade really, really wants it and pushes TfL hard enough for it, then maybe that's something they could look at.
I think that was something they was talking about if they do move again, was reintroducing
the
counter service. Whether it actually
They're moving to what? Butlers? I mean, there's no parking, right? I mean, I think that's another big challenge anyway you move to. I mean, is, you know, where do you pull up? Where do where do you actually park? I mean, at least at Penton Street, I guess there was the yard behind, although most people would park off street, I think, in the area when they went into the office.
I think a lot of people parked on the meters when they went up there.
Yeah,
I mean, you can always find somewhere to park with meters or parking bays or car parks whatever, but it's one of them things that can be overcome, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So, getting onto the subject of private hire vehicles.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Private hire.
My favourite.
satellite offices came into being before you became director.
They did, yeah.
And obviously, what are your views on satellite offices, John?
Well, they certainly caused me no end of trouble. I'll give you that. And I think there's some people out there probably listening to this show that I've got video recordings of me on my first days in the job, going up to Abacus, I think, with some of the trade reps and getting the earful from the doorman there. Look, I can understand why they were introduced to a certain extent. Do I think that they were issued, licenses were issued a bit too liberally? Yeah, absolutely. You know, I totally agree that it's unacceptable that to have private hire licenses issued to, you know, corner shops and supermarkets and, you know, little cubby holes next to sex shops. That's absolutely not what I think was intended, but it's what I would call an unintended consequence. And once you issue these licenses, it's very difficult to get them back.
Yeah.
You know, me and Helen did spend a lot of time listening to trade reps, understanding their concerns. When I came in, there was an intention to do a private hire consultation on changing the regulations for private hire operators and vehicles and stuff. And actually, the very first version I read was about one page. There wasn't anything really in there. So I decided, well, actually, not to issue that consultation, listen to the concerns of the trade, what were the issues. You know, we didn't just have satellite offices issues. We had issues about signage on private hire vehicles, the question whether should taxis be black and private hire be silver, and all these types of issues. What level should private hire minicabs have, pre-booked only, down the side, all those issues. And we put that all into the document, the consultation document. And of course, what happens is you get the taxi trade on one hand saying, absolutely, we want all of these things and more. And you get the minicab trade and the private hire trade saying, absolutely not, we want less regulation and less bureaucracy. And what invariably happens is you do a report, you identify those things that you think you can implement, and it goes up the tree in terms of sign-off. And, you know, there's plenty of things that I still think should and could be done to properly regulate minicabs more than they are being, but it needs a political will. It needs people to be able to be willing to put their name and say, well, actually, no, we're going to revoke licenses from some of these locations because they are a safety to the public, and actually, if they want to take us to court, then let them take us to court. I have to say that in my 4 years, I felt that the taxi trade had a lot of valid arguments when it came to some of their issues. Sometimes not. I mean, I'm not sold on the argument that all taxis should be black and all minicabs should be silver. Personally, I can understand why some people think that having a sign along the side of a vehicle might say pre-booked only. But you know, in the 4 years, no one really put a lot of evidence in front of me or TfL to say there's a real issue with this. You'd get anecdotal stuff. I mean, people used to tweet me now and again saying, you know, I just saw somebody trying to hail a Vito minicab.
Yeah,
that's fine. But is that a one-off? Is it a big issue? And what's the impact? And it's that real hard evidence that I think is sometimes needed to convince organisations like TfL and politicians that you really need to make a change. And unless you put the hard evidence in front of them, then they tend to go with the status quo. And I'll be fair to them, to the private hire trade. They've got deep pockets and they've got a lot of influence and they do a lot of good lobbying at a political level. And unfortunately, they do tend to get what they want.
Yeah.
And this perhaps goes to something you and I were talking about a bit earlier about, you know, taxi trade unity. And they do seem to be, on the private hire side, they do seem to be a little bit more coordinated.
A bit more cohesive.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have the issues, of course, most of the, in the minicab trade, in the private hire trade.
It's mainly
the operators. There isn't any voice really for the drivers. Drivers are, you know, they don't, you know, even the GMB, who say they represent most of the minicab drivers. I went to some of the GMB AGMs, and there'd be like six people around this table with a picture of Karl Marx in the corner, and so, you know, I found, you know, despite all of those things, you know, people might not fully appreciate this, but the approach that I tried to do, or the approach that I was expected to have, was kind of a neutral one. an impartial one. And I know that sometimes people just think that that's, they can't understand that. And in that case, what you should have is a director of taxes and a director of private hire. But I tell you, that wouldn't work.
Someone over them.
You know, so all that would happen would be you'd have double the costs of two. You'd have two directors, and at some point, somebody at a political level has to make a decision. I mean, the easy one was the private hire and bus lanes. I mean, I was quite proud of my achievements in that respect. You know, it all kicked off, I think, one day when Grant either phoned me up or sent me a letter that he'd seen from an Addison Lee driver. From today, you can drive. I think it was Friday night all night, or Saturday night. And I got on the phone to Grant on Saturday night. And, you know, I worked Saturday night, Sunday night, Monday. You know, we worked really hard because, absolutely, it is TfL's view and certainly my view. They're called bus lanes for the buses, but they've historically been used by taxis because, for a very good reason. And, you know, I really worked hard to, you know, it was my statement that got presented to the High Court. You know, I worked with the TfL legal team to make sure that we got the right result on that. And I don't even know where it is now. I don't know if it's still dragging on. And
no, it's been somewhere and they've
kicked it out or whatever. I don't know.
Basically upheld what TfL said.
Well, so, you know, I mean, you know, you get accused. It's interesting because you get accused of bias by taxi trade to the minicabs, and you get exactly right, Jamie. You get exactly the same coming back. But you know,
so you're there to do a job, and your job was to administer both trades. So
you can't.
I got the impression, as I said earlier, that you had more respect for the taxi trade than you did the private hire trade, but you couldn't be seen to show that.
I mean, I have no qualms. There's nothing that stops me saying that, you know, I had way more respect for the taxi trade, way more respect for the representation from the taxi trade. For whoever's listening, whether they're a member of the RMT, the UCG, LCDC, whoever it is, LTDA or whatever, every one of the people that I've ever come across in the taxi trade that are representing drivers in those associations have always been very firm, very strong, very clear in their demands. But almost 99%, there's been an occasion, almost 99%, they've always been respectful, willing to have a 2-hour slog off on and a meeting about, you know, key issues, and then on the way out, you know, should we go for a pint or, you know.
Yeah.
Someone will probably say fish and chips. I only ever went for fish and chips once, by the way.
That's the way it should be,
though. Yeah. But with the minicab trade and the private hire trade.
Let me just take you back a minute.
Yeah, go on then.
So you only went for fish and chips once?
With Grant, yeah. I know some people would
think it was a regular occurrence.
Some people would have it that I was out with Grant and Daryl and the LCDC guys probably once a week. But no, I think we only ever went for fish and chips once while I was in the job. And we went for fish and chips after I'd left. TfL.
And then
I think I returned the favour. I took actually, when I think about it, I'm sure my meal cost me more. I took Grant and Daryl to Gaucho for a nice steak. But at some point they need to return the favour. But look, you know, joking aside, you know, I've had some right ding dongs with Grant. I've had ding dongs with Grant, Steve, Bob, yourself. The UCG members, John Kennedy in the RMT, Mick Bailey, you know, if we all got on with each other. But then I think this goes back to what you were saying, Jamie, was my job was not necessarily the job that the taxi trade or the reps wanted me to have.
Yeah.
They wanted me sometimes to perhaps lean towards the taxi trade more than I could. But I certainly had a lot more respect for them. And, you know, I've got no problem saying it. A lot of the reasons why I ultimately ended up leaving TfL were down to the private eye trade. Mm. Were, you know, they weren't happy. I think they would blame me for, you know, the fact that it's raining today, you know, if they could. But, you know, they did a long list of gripes and moans to the mayor about, you know, how they weren't happy with this and this and this and all the, you know, John Mason's not impartial and you know, the, you know, we don't get the attention we deserve, we don't get the attention, you know, we never get what we want, etc., etc. And actually, you know, no matter how much time I used to spend with those guys, you know, they just would never kind of accept that what I was saying, you know, for a good example was, you know, the LOCOG made during the Olympics, the ODA made a decision that all taxi drivers would get a handbook, but minicab drivers wouldn't.
Yeah.
What they'd do is they'd send the operators a handbook and ask the minicab. Well, it all kicked off and it was all my fault. And I was like, it's the ODA, the ODA's decision. Yeah. Access to bus lane, even though it was quite clear it was a TfL decision to defend.
It's your fault.
It was my fault, personal fault. So you have to live with that. That's the job I was being paid for. I'm not getting my violin out or anything like that. But yeah, I mean, you're right. You guys work hard. You know, you do more. We were talking before we came on air about the Disney trip and, you know, the hard work. And not just the Disney trip, the Albany trip and the Normandy stuff and the, you know, all the stuff. You know, the huge amount of work and effort that goes into charity work. And then you've only got to pick up a copy of a trade paper or follow Twitter. And how many times you see, you know, a taxi driver went above and beyond the call of duty, returning, you know, lost property, taking people and waiving the fare because, you know, they feel sorry for them. You know, I mean, you don't, and again, that's another reason why I think the trade in London is so loved, because those things happen not just once every blue moon, they happen every day.
So would you have liked to stay in the job, John?
Do you know what? I think...
Or do you think you'd had your
time? I think I'd probably had my time. I, you know, for the last year of my time in TfL, I wasn't really... Helen was really more in... I was doing other work. So yeah. I was working on this programme, this change programme in Surface. So I wasn't really paying... And I was also trying to look after congestion charging and traffic enforcement again.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really doing a lot. Helen was really in charge of the directorate. And I was doing stuff off... in other areas of surface transport. I certainly look back on my time in TfL fondly. I mean, it was the best period of my career to date. And, you know, for all the criticism it gets from all quarters, not just, you know, yeah, taxi and private eye trade, but, you know, cycling lobbies now and, you know, freight lobby groups. There's a lot of really, really good people who work there. And it was a big decision for me. It was a hard decision for me. But, you know, you just think, well, actually, maybe it is time to move on and do something different. And, you know, it's also important that you actually get on and respect the people you're working for, yeah, higher up the chain. And
I've got the impression that wasn't the case towards the end.
I don't want to say too much, but, you know, towards the end, I think it was quite clear that, you know, to me, it was quite clear, and somebody might say differently, that there wasn't really any desire to make any effort to keep me if I wanted to go. So you kind of know, your time to move on. And but, you know, it was a real, you know, do an interview with Helen and she might tell you one day about that. You know, yeah. I came down from the 11th floor to see Helen on my way out of the building on the 24th of September, and she will tell you how gutted I was to be leaving.
Yeah.
And I was gutted.
Was it your decision, John?
Obviously. It was. Yeah.
It was your decision.
So I had the chance to stay.
Yeah.
I can't go into much detail, but I was offered a role, and unfortunately the discussions, and it wasn't about money in the end, it was about
respect
and whether you felt your face fitted going forward, and just kind of reached the conclusion that, you know, it's probably time to move on. Yeah, it's right to move on. And do you know what? I've missed everybody over the past year or so. I still get to see a lot of people. I got a text the other day from Helen saying, was I up for the Christmas party, the TPH Christmas party? I don't know. If I can, I will. Because, you know, I've got a lot of respect for the guys there. No matter, you know, yes, no one's perfect. You know, there was plenty of time in the 4 years that I was there that we made some monumental cock-ups and did things wrong.
That's
life. Yeah, and I'll tell you one thing I never did. It was shy away from when we did make a cock-up. I'd hold our hands up And if we made a mistake, we'd hold our hands up and we'd be honest and open. If the service wasn't good enough, at least we actually had the data. So we would go sometimes into our meetings with the taxi trade reps or the private hire trade reps and say, our service is, you know, we've been monitoring our call answering times, or we've been doing this activity and we know we're not up to scratch, and this is what we're doing about it. Whereas before, that data didn't exist, and you know, so yeah, there's a lot of things we did, there's a lot of things we achieved, not all of them, you know, it's like, you know, I spent a huge amount of my first 6 months just working on the air quality strategy, and I'm not going to get any thanks for that from the taxi trade or the private hire trade, but that was my job, as you said, Jamie. My job, I was being paid to sit down round a table with taxi trade reps and in forums and try and convince people, trade reps, to accept a 15-year age limit, because that's what the mayor wanted, that's what the strategy was. And to be honest with you, I think it's, I know there's been criticism in the past, but it was only through some of the intense lobbying that went on from all parties, not just the ones sat round the table, but ones that weren't round the table, that there was a revision of the consultation.
So
and
you do, I mean, obviously, you the UTG, as the you obviously met with them, but you
yeah.
So you took notice of the submissions from the RMT.
You were legally obliged to, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, I used to have the, I mean, you know, I used to have this conversation quite a bit with either.
So where did the engagement policy come about?
Oh, yeah, well, I wrote that. And it was my idea. So I wasn't told to write. I didn't get told to write it. You know, it was my idea. Was, you know, came into this job, was told by Ed when I came in, you know, these are the people we sit around the table with. You know, we speak to everybody, but these are the people that come in and we formally engage in. You know, Unison, LCDC, LTDA, and I thought, okay, right, but you've got the I think it was the RMT, there might have been the UCG at the time, or just coming in, but they're on the outside, and they want to come in and they want to sit round the top table, and it's seen as this top table, and it's just, in my mind, it doesn't exist, and I know people think they're missing out, or they think that, you know, conversations go on behind closed doors that are kind of trying to actually destroy the RMT or these groups that are on the outside, but it's just not the case. I would have preferred to be able to sit down with everybody, but I do think there are perhaps understandable vested interests. You know, so let me turn it on his head, because I had this conversation, so you have to bear with me, it is a good example. I remember being outside, I can't know, some venue or whatever, and I can't remember who it was, from the RMT, was saying to me, he said, you know, we should be round the table, we've just got as much right to sit round that table as the LCD. I said, if you had 10,000 members, and you'd been established, and you'd been sat round the table, and this newly formed organisation said, well, we're not happy with our representation for the RMT, we demand to be round the table, what would your response be? And I think the response was, oh, yeah, well, we would welcome them with open arms. And I'm sorry, I just don't believe that would be the case.
So, I mean, obviously, the RMT got more members than Unite.
Right, yeah. So those are the cons. So I came up, and perhaps, you know, it's wrong or whatever, I came up with what I deemed to be a fair, people I've seen so many times, what's it been? It's a gagging order, it's this, it's that, it's another. All it was intended to be was a framework which said, these are the three that currently sit around the table. On a formal basis, they're not, you know, we don't, it's not excluding anyone, you know, you can't, you know, and hopefully some people in the RMT and indeed the UCG would agree with this, that I've always said, you know, if you want me to meet you, if you want to pick up the phone, you've got member issues, do everything I can to respond and all that kind of stuff, and I did that without question. But in terms of formal meetings and having formal meetings with trade reps that we could manage in a kind of civil way, not that, you know, whatever we TFL or I said go, when, or if, you know, gagged Grant or Bob for telling me you know, what they thought of a particular decision, because I can guarantee you they were very forthright in their views. It was intended as a kind of, at least some, to provide some kind of structure which said, you get X, and you know, you meet a kind of membership threshold, you can come around the table.
What was the threshold set?
I can't remember now. Was it 5% or
5%?
I can't remember. Yeah, I mean, was it about 5%? I don't know. You know, I don't know. I mean, do you know what? You know what? If I felt that you could have a session with all of those people in the same room and it having a positive outcome, then I would have tried to perhaps do more to make that happen.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid, I think it is. And I still see it now, you know. How long I've been out of it? You know, 12, 13, 14 months.
I try to keep
an interest. And, you know, you see, we demand trade loyalty. Grants are deep, beep. Or, you know, we demand trade loyalty. The RMT are beep. And you think, actually, how are you ever going to get? You know, do you think I would sit, you know, if somebody, you know, was to constantly slag me off, you know, say that I'm worthless, say that I'm a stool pigeon, or say that I'm this, that and the other, and then seriously sit round a table. So I think the trade have got a kind of bit of a problem there, that until perhaps people can put aside what's gone on in the past, until people are willing to say, well, actually, until the RMT, I'm not singling people out, but until the RMT would be perhaps willing to say, you know, LTDA have got a valid reason why they're the LTDA, and we respect them, and we respect people's opinions, and respect the input, and respect what they've done, then I can't ever see the RMT getting on with the LTDA. And it's just like, funny. It just reminds me of Life of Brian sometimes, you know, and that famous scene.
One group said so far that they've stopped it, they've actually banned any of their committee from slagging off any other user.
Oh, right,
exactly.
Who's the
LTDA?
LTDA.
Cab Chat Radio Show is brought to you in association with Plan Insurance, who you can call on 0800 542 2869 or find them on the web at planinsurance.co.uk/cabchat, and Driver Tax, who you can call on 0208 529 2600. You can also find them on the web at drivertax.co.uk.